The Guardian.
Scientists, as we know them, are tasked with helping us understand our world. They study and analyse.
Jane Goodall, armed only with binoculars, departs for the first time into the African forest, where earliest known man probably lived more than a million years ago.
They make new discoveries.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
When the science is right, they help move humanity forward.
And then Tim Berners-Lee shows up in 1991 and releases the World Wide Web.
But what about when science is wrong? Over the years, bad studies have been called out across research fields, spanning the breadth of science. Dubious claims in the name of science have led to record numbers of studies being retracted, while scores more turn out to be unreplicable. So what's gone wrong with the pursuit of knowledge? And more to the point, can we fix it? I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly. To help me turn the lens on science, I spoke with someone who has used evolutionary theory and analysis to investigate how science has gone astray.
I'm Richard McElreath. I'm director of the Department of Human Behavior, Ecology and Culture at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany.
Richard co-authored a study which found that, in fact, natural selection in the world of science has made way for bad science. I asked Richard to start by painting us a picture of how science is practiced today and what motivates those who work in the field.
I believe scientists are motivated by trying to figure out how nature works, how the universe functions, and how human societies function within the context of nature. That isn't to say that there aren't more Machiavellian actors, as in all industries, but most scientists are pretty idealistic when you talk to them. That said, that primary motivation has to be shaped by the fact that science is now an industrial occupation. It's very large scale, and it's incredibly competitive, and it's become quite quantified, like many other industries. And so as a result, our top-level philosophical desire to figure out true facts about the universe is molded into particular forms that allow us to be successful. It's important to note that there's frustration that a lot of the way we work is attempting to run around the industrial obstacles.
So take us through some of the incentives that are there to shape how scientists work.
The top line incentives are all examples of cases where there are bottlenecks through the intense competitiveness of the field. And so every stage of our work involves intense competition for resources and access to audiences. So this begins from the desire to get into a PhD program. There's intense competition. Then there's intense competition for funding. And by intense here, I should say, we're talking about selection where 5 to 10% of the pool is going to get into a competitive situation where they'll have the resources to do the work they originally intended to do. On to the competition for publication, which is the most famous competitive arena. And since PhD students are being produced at very high rates, we now have a backlog of people with excellent educations who do not have permanent positions in science. These competitive factors become very dire. And when I got a job, when I got my first job, I think I had two publications. And I got an assistant professor job. And that wasn't so unusual at the time. I was fortunate I came from a good PhD program, an advisor who's well known in the field. But two publications, I hazard to say nobody gets hired on two publications anymore. It's virtually impossible. These days, someone like me would be competing against a big field of postdoctoral scholars, many of whom are on their third postdoc. They might have 20, 30 papers in excellent journals, and those are the people who are getting assistant professor jobs now. It's really quite an extraordinary change.
With extreme pressure on scientists to publish papers to fill out their portfolios, the pursuit of knowledge becomes a case of survival of the fittest. So what does the situation look like from the position of those hiring new recruits? And what does that tell us about how research is developed?
No one's a bad actor. No one's intentionally trying to sabotage these things. It's just, you can imagine with a job posting, you get 800 applicants. Or at a granting agency, there are a lot of grants and they have to be triaged. And so proxies get used and people use the best proxies that may be available to them. Things like impact factor. Impact factor is not something that was sanctioned by any academic organization. It was created by a publisher to advertise their products.
And just explain what an impact factor is.
An impact factor is the rate at which papers in journals, in a particular journal, are cited. Authors want their papers in high impact factor journals because in some countries, your promotion involves a calculation using a formula that includes the impact factor of the journals you have published in. What we want is true results, but journals often select for, well, hype. Editors are incentivized to take on papers which will give their journals high impact. And editors have deliberately gamed the system in many times to elevate the positions of their journals as well. It was considered doing good for the journal, and therefore you can attract better papers. So if you're selecting, for example, on the surprise value of a result, there are many things that can make a result surprising other than its truth value. What used to be an informal proxy is that people knew, yes, if you get a paper in Science or Nature or Proceedings, a National Academy of Sciences or a Royal Society journal, more people will see it, it's likely to be cited more. That became, I use the word industrialized, it became an industrial standard. And then universities and academic societies took it on board as a proxy, which made it possible to process large numbers of people and papers and applications. You will find occasional people who defend the criteria, but the system is very sticky. And so trying to get enough people to coordinate simultaneously to change the institution has been difficult.
What is the negative consequence of the emphasis on publications?
As a consequence, if you reward something other than, say, detailed judgment and debate about the truth value of the work and instead reward something else like productivity, then what you get is more productivity and not more of the thing you want.
In their study into the natural selection of bad science, Richard and his co-author Paul Smaldino at the University of California, Merced, argued that the scientific community is creating a situation where, if a scientist can produce more papers with less data, they can get more grants to keep their longer-term research pursuits alive. I asked Richard to unpack this argument and explain what it comes down to in the lab.
So labs will do a lot of small studies, small, cheap studies, small numbers of subjects, small numbers of replicate units, and they only publish the ones that work out. Because if you do enough of them, you farm asterisks. This is what I call it. Why asterisk? Because statistical software puts an asterisk by a significant result. If you run enough small, cheap studies, you maximize the chance that you can get one asterisk. And then that lets you get a publication and lets you get your next grant.
So an asterisk means that this is a positive finding of statistical significance.
Exactly. And I jokingly call it stargazing. You need to harvest the stars. The individuals who do them are not cheating. They don't hide these behaviors. They're in print as advice.
But give us a sense of how damaging, how problematic this is.
I wish I could. I think it's very hard to measure precisely the damage. But I think in general, the quantitative assessment of damage would come from the replication projects that have gone on. For example, pharmaceutical industries are interested in making cancer treatment drugs from initial positive lab results for cancer drugs. And so they first set about just trying to replicate the published papers. And 80% of them could not be replicated. And this is in an industry where they're trying really hard to do it because they want to get the profit stream going, right? And to do that, the thing needs to work.
In their study into the natural selection of bad science, Richard and his co-author Paul Smaldino at the University of California, Merced, argued that the scientific community is creating a situation where if a scientist can produce more papers with less data, they can get more grants to keep their longer-term research pursuits alive. I asked Richard to unpack this argument and explain what it comes down to in the lab.
In labs, junior scientists have been explicitly taught for several generations now that the way to be successful, and that means to publish, but also to discover things, is to run a bunch of small treatments to measure a bunch of potential outcomes. And then the ones with asterisks are the correct things. Those are the true findings. And you publish those, and you don't have to mention the other thing.
You've said that these are issues that have been raised time and again, that the need for improving science is not a new one. What should be done? Do scientists agree on what has to be done and how that might be achieved?
I don't think that there's precise agreement on remedies. It's not a simple issue of, say, a typical industrial situation, so that's frustrating. And there are many attempts now to come up with new institutions.
According to Richard, awareness of these issues is improving. But we need to remember that these mechanisms have been in place a long time. Historically, he says, scholars have raised concerns about them for years. After the break, we'll turn to two scientists from different areas of research to help broaden the scope of the conversation and discuss the general problems at hand.
Even that question of what constitutes a wrong finding is not simple.
And what other issues we need to keep our eyes on.
There should be space created so that there is more time available to do this essential work.
More of that when we return.
Hi, it's Daniel Glazer here. Our latest episode of A Neuroscientist Explains looks at an issue in the world of psychology, the so-called replication crisis.
People read that and said that cannot possibly be correct. So either something's broken about the scientific publishing process, or everything we've ever known isn't true. Psychology and science in general is self-correcting, but only if we actually do the correcting. And it's great to see that there's more emphasis on doing this correcting and being sure about our hypotheses.
To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search A Neuroscientist Explains on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Earlier, I spoke with Professor Richard McElreath at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. He's shed light on the fact that good science is being thwarted by systems that encourage high productivity. Productivity, he argues, comes at the expense of what we really want, which is true knowledge about the world. I invited two guests with different scientific backgrounds to help broaden out the conversation.
I'm Uta Frith. I'm Emeritus Professor of Cognitive Development at UCL, and I'm also Chair of the Diversity Committee at the Royal Society.
I'm Marcus Manafo. I'm Professor of Biological Psychology at the University of Bristol.
I started by asking them why, so long after the birth of science, we have yet to perfect the scientific process.
Well, you're right that the scientific method has been around for a long time, but I think we need to distinguish between the scientific method, which is relatively abstract, and the day-to-day practice of doing science. It's also worth bearing in mind that in science generally, we accept that we're almost never completely right about something. We just try to become gradually less wrong by updating our beliefs with evidence over time. And I think we can apply the same thinking to how we do science. We might be doing an okay job, but that doesn't mean that we can't improve on things.
How does it look from your point of view, Uta? Have we got science pretty well nailed down, or is there a lot of room for improvement?
My take on this is that science has been around probably for only four centuries. It is still an incredibly young enterprise compared, for example, to our legal systems, which have been around 4,000 years.
Something as broad an enterprise as science is bound to have all manner of shortcomings, but do you, Marcus, see systemic problems that undermine its potential effectiveness?
I think we need to be a little bit careful not to overstate the situation. It's always a good idea to look at how we work and decide whether or not we're doing things as efficiently, as effectively as we can be, and whether our ways of working can be updated given some of the new technologies that are available to us. So I think that the period that we're going through at the moment, where people are thinking about methods and the robustness of scientific findings, is healthy, and it's best seen as an opportunity to improve the way that we work and bring our practices up to date.
We think of science, certainly on the Science Weekly podcast anyway, we think of science as one of the best ways humans have come up with for getting at the truth. Are scientists incentivized in the right way to get to the truth?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting questions. To a large extent, we're not, because the sorts of things that you get rewarded for in science directly are publishing, particularly in certain kinds of journals, getting grants, for example. All of those things are great and we are acknowledged for. But actually, being right is not something that we're directly rewarded for. It's what we go into science for. We want to find things out. We're enthusiastic about our subject area and we're excited about what we do. But we gradually realize through our early careers, particularly, that if we don't publish in the right kinds of journals, for example, then we won't have a career to allow us to do the thing that we came into science for in the first place. So there's a mismatch between what's good for science and what's good for scientists' careers, if you like.
And is that how you would see it as well, Uta? I mean, is it more important in a scientist's career almost that they rack up a lot of publications rather than that they are right all the time?
Well, I definitely think that there is a problem, not with science, but possibly with scientists, and only in such a sense that we're all human beings. We do want to get at the truth, of course, but there are all these other things, like, you know, getting a job, getting reputation, getting money, all of these things. And these problems are not specific to science. Perhaps it is the case that we're more aware in science that people, human beings, are subject to all these things because there is a need to get money from somewhere. And that is a danger because that can obscure this search for the truth.
And I think Uta picks up on something very interesting there, which is that however well-trained we are as scientists, we're still humans. And one of the reasons I think psychologists have been at the forefront of this recent debate around reproducibility is because many of the issues we're talking about are issues of human behavior and the cognitive biases that we all have. The fact that we see patterns in noise, for example, we see, you know, the face of Jesus in toast. That cognitive bias, which is an evolutionary throwback, if you like, can lead us astray when we're dealing with noisy data sets in any number of different sciences.
There is undoubtedly, though, a lot of science that's published every day, every week, every month that is wrong or at least badly flawed. Some people may dismiss this as, look, it's just lab experiments. Or other people might think, well, science is self-correcting, that there is this built-in way of making sure that bad results do not get taken up. Is it an issue?
There are lots of levels to that question. First of all, we need to think about what it means to say that something is wrong. So, for example, you might observe a pattern in your data and that pattern may be robust and replicable across lots of different samples, but your interpretation of what that means, for example, does it reflect a cause and effect relationship, may be wrong. Or it may be that the observation in the first place was just a chance finding and doesn't replicate across different samples. Or it may be that someone overly aggressively interpreted their data or dealt with outliers in a slightly unprincipled way and generated a result that was spurious for that reason. So even that question of what constitutes a wrong finding is not simple. I think the need for replication and also to come at a research question from different directions is really important. One of the approaches that we're increasingly trying to adopt in Bristol in the groups that I'm part of is triangulation, this idea of coming at the same question from different directions with each methodology or approach having its own assumptions, its own strengths and weaknesses. And critically, if those are different strengths and weaknesses and different assumptions and different biases, but they all give the same answer, then you can be more confident in the robustness of that answer. So a good example of a finding that is robust is the J-shaped relationship between alcohol and heart disease, this idea that a little bit of alcohol consumption is good for you. And that's complicated by the fact that the kinds of people that drink a little bit of alcohol are different to the kinds of people who drink a lot of alcohol and to those who drink no alcohol at all. And so understanding whether that relationship, which is absolutely robust, genuinely reflects a protective effect of alcohol as opposed to confounding, for example, is extremely difficult.
I want to get a sense from both of you about how much you feel diversity feeds into some of these issues in science. We know that there are issues around diversity in terms of gender, ethnicity, but also political leanings in academia. What are those diversity issues, and do you think they have an impact on the science itself?
I think, yes, they are very important because science is essentially dependent on teamwork. You know, it's become very complex. It's become very difficult to master all the different techniques that you need. You know, it's a little bit like getting players in team sports together. They're all specialists in different different areas and different skills. And in science, we need theorists, we need experimenters, we need explorers, we need exploiters. All of these people somehow have to discuss things together. And you really need to have diverse viewpoints. Otherwise, you know, if you're very, very similar in your beliefs, in your prior upbringing, your background, and so on, in your aims, you are very likely to be trapped in a local minimum. You think you've found the answer to everything.
If you could wave a wand and start all over again with science, how would you build it up to make sure that it does give you the truth more reliably than the science we have today?
I think I would change the incentives, and I would make it clear that there is enough time that is given to do some good research. And my main wish would be to have an agreement that we must value quality over quantity.
Marcus?
Well, I think we have to realise that although that's a nice thought experiment, we're in the messier situation of having to update an ecosystem that we're already part of. And that's much harder to do, but that's the situation that's facing us, if you like. I completely agree with everything that Uta's saying. In fact, I think that it again speaks to some of the different biases that we all have and that we need to recognize if we're going to improve the way that we work. Confirmation bias being, I think, the one that Uta was essentially talking about, this tendency that we have to seek out information that confirms our belief rather than disconfirms our belief. And approaches like triangulation are an active attempt to seek out disconfirming approaches, if you like, which is how science should work. But given current incentive structures, isn't always the way that it does work in practice. But I think while there are many different things that we could try to do to improve the way that we work, and we're going through a period where people are experimenting with different approaches that might help with that, one of the areas that I think we are trying to do better, and which I think can really benefit the quality of what we do, is team science, which again speaks to this issue of diversity, bringing in people with different methodological and disciplinary backgrounds to work on a common project, but also to take into account other types of diversity, like not just gender and ethnic diversity, which we have been thinking about for some time now, but also political diversity, socioeconomic diversity. Academia tends to be a relatively homogenous place in many respects along all of those different dimensions. And the more that we can break that up and bring in different voices, different perspectives, different life experiences, the better able we will, through that team science approach, to be able to adopt this kind of triangulation approach that we've been talking about.
Science is, in many parts of the world, under threat, that there are people out there who do not take it very seriously. Does something have to change pretty swiftly and pretty majorly?
I think we need to be careful not to allow others to weaponize the reproducibility debate by using it as a means by which they can drive a wedge between scientists and the general public. So we mustn't be too nihilistic about where science is. Science is still making progress, is still giving us insights into nature in an unprecedented way. We need to, if anything, say we are so mature as a discipline that we're starting to take this more introspective approach to see how we can be even better. But that's a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness.
I completely agree. I think science is indeed the best thing we have to get at the truth. We do need the truth to get better solutions to all the problems. If we can really agree politically that there should be space created so that there is more time available to do this essential work, it would benefit everyone.
Going back to my conversation with Richard, he found that both the history of the field, as well as what he sees in the community today, both give him hope for science.
There's a fantastic book I like called The Lost Elements. It's a history of the periodic table of elements. It turns out that there were more false discoveries of atomic elements than there are true elements known. But this isn't a book of fraudsters, although there are fraudsters in the book. But for the most part, it's honest scientists using what were at the time cutting-edge methods, but which we would now regard as incredibly silly, struggling to discover and get famous from new building blocks of the natural world. Now, when you open up a chemistry textbook, you don't see any of this. You get it like this immutable, permanent knowledge about the universe, true everywhere. And I believe that. but it was cobbled together through an incredibly messy and embarrassing process. So now chemistry kind of looks like a complete field to us, and we sweep away all of the storm and drama that preceded that completion. And we look instead at the behavioral sciences, the biological sciences, and we see that things are very messy. But that's just like the other sciences. The improvement here in having hope, I have tremendous hope, partly because of that historical perspective. And there's so much consciousness now, there's much more open discussion. And it seems to me the junior scientists in particular, although of course they're under tremendous hierarchical pressure to conform to expectation, they're ideologically way more activist about science reform than my generation was.
Special thanks this week to Richard McElreath, Uta Frith, and Marcus Manafo. If you want to find out more about Richard's study, we'll include a link to that in the episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
From The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.